Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is an educational service in public interest. I'm your narrator, George Horton. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Hell's Kitchen when we come back. Well, during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and they helped to provide their own food and fiber for themselves and for their country. Well, today, over half the food we eat is imported from outside of our borders. Our food is produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce and is nutritionally deficient. And Adolf Steinbaum of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter into perspective by having samples of corn tested for the nutrients usually added to commercial feeds. Now, compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Steinbaum's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, 205% more manganese, and the same result has also been seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. And in the opinion of many ecologic farmers, hybrid seed merely masks poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing the book Hell's Kitchen by Joel Wallach. Hell's Kitchen is a 1 in 100 read. You won't find another book like it. Well, you might have to read 100 books before you find one like it. I've never seen a health book written quite the way Wallach writes. He's kind of like a Mark Twain. I mentioned that to you last time. He just has a writing style. He's kind of funny. He's kind of fun. He's interesting. It's always educational. There's always something new on the next page. He's going to tell you something you didn't know before. You know, I'm an old man. If anybody ought to know it all, it ought to be me. I'm old enough to just about know it all. I learn something new every time I turn the page reading this guy's material. Of course, I guess that isn't too tough to do because I'm not really all that bright, but I like to think I am. I'm going to turn over here to page 47, chapter 4, Hospitals, the Road to Hell. You know, if you're not safe in the hospital, where in the hell are you going to be safe? Where could there be a safer place than the hospital, for crying out loud? Well, Wallach, in his inimitable way, points out that hospitals are pretty dangerous places. And hospitals kill a lot of people every year. Now, there's about 37 million people here in the United States that are going to go to the hospital this year. In the year 2007, about 37 million people are going to go in the hospital. 130,000 of them aren't going to come out because they were given bad medicines. They were given the wrong prescription, or they were given the wrong dosage, or they were given too much or not enough of it. That's the drug-induced deaths. I think that's 130,000. Then there's another group over here, about 90,000. They're going to die from infection. They're going to go into the hospital, and they're going to pick up a staph infection, and they're going to die from it. And then there's another group of people. It's about 100,000. And they're going to be killed by the doctors. The doctor's going to go in there and cut off the wrong breast. He's going to cut off the wrong leg. He's going to cut out the wrong lung. That's about another 100,000. So in round numbers, it's about 300,000 a year, and that's what they admit to. You got that? That's what they admit to. And of course, they lie all the time. And if I was killing, 130,000 people a year, you know, I wouldn't want to tell you, well, I'm killing 130,000. I'd water it down until I kill 90. Tell you what a tragic error that is, and how we got to work real hard and fix that. And they've been telling us that for years. You've got to work real hard and fix that. Now, 300,000 a year, give yourself a little perspective here. Do you know how many people die in car wrecks every year? 50,000 a year. We kill 300,000 in our hospitals. 50,000 die every year from auto wrecks. We get excited. We hire highway patrols, and we get on insurance and bandwagons, and we get mad mothers drunk over bad drunk drivers and just all kinds of crazy crap like that. Over 50,000 people getting killed. 58,000 died in Vietnam. My God, we rioted in the streets over 58,000 people dying in 10 years. That's only 5,800 a year. Rioting in the streets. Six times more than that every year. I don't see anybody rioting in the streets or getting excited about these 300,000 people that are dying in our hospitals every year from infection, from iatrogenic disease, or from drugs. And we're not talking about illegal drugs. We're talking about legal drugs kill 130,000 a year. So I just rounded off to 100,000, 100,000, and 100,000. It's actually 100,000, 90, 130. But, you know, be intelligent and reasonable. Give them the benefit of the doubt. And that's what they admit to. It's probably two or three times that. Probably. I see other numbers over here. They tell us that it's way higher than that. But, you know, just taking the official numbers over there, it'd gag a maggot at high noon with both hands on the roadmap. So Joel Wallach puts a chapter in here. He calls the hospitals the road to hell and gives us a little history about hospitals. I didn't know this. I'm gonna share it with you. Listen to this. The appearance of medieval hospitals were, in effect, logical extensions of religious altruism. Those established in the West were initially small and originally erected for the benefit of religious pilgrims. Later versions of hospitals were more expensive and provided a wider service for more people. St. Leonard's in York had 225 beds for the sick and poor in 1287 AD. Even larger were the secular hospitals of Milan, Siena, and Paris. In Florence, Italy, a city with a population of 30,000, there were more than 30 hospital foundations by the 15th century. Many had only 10 beds, while some others boasted hundreds of beds. In England, hospitals and almshouses numbered about 500 by 1400. However, only a few were of any significant size. London's St. Bartholomew's dates back to 1123, and St. Thomas from 1215. At Berry Street, Edmonds, six hospitals were endowed between 1150 and 1260 to care for lepers, pilgrims, the infirm, and the aged. Now, the Crusades played a large role in hospital expansion. Crusading orders, including the Knights of St. John, later to be called the Knights of Malta, the Knights of Templar, and the Teutonic Knights, all built hospitals in the Mediterranean and Germanic territories. By 1300, non-military brotherhoods, including the Order of the Holy Spirit, were supporting clinics from Alsace to Poland. The Order of St. John of God built insane asylums in 1500 in Spain and about 200 hospitals in the New World. Originally, small hospitals were hostels or hospices that lacked medical support. By 1215, physicians were on full-time staff at the Paris Hotel Dieu near Notre Dame and Stay Maria in Florence from 12 beds in 1288 for the sick and poor to a medical staff of 10 doctors, a pharmacist, and several assistants, including a female surgeon, by 1500. The golden age of hospital building during the 1200s occurred at the same time as the founding of universities in Italy, Spain, France, and England. Paris University was founded in 1110, Bologna in 1158, Oxford in 1167, Montpellier in 1181, Cambridge in 1209, Pouda in 1222, and Naples in 1224. Well, by the 1230s, Montpellier was attracting medical students from distant places. Initially, medical schools developed in an eclectic fashion like Topsy. However, the staff eventually formed formal faculties for mutual protection and job security. Thank God, here comes the union. There were significant philosophical differences between the clerically administered hospitals of Paris, Cologne, and Oxford, where the religious beliefs of the faculty dominated all things, and the non-denominational universities such as Montpellier in Italy, where the arts and law faculties dominated. At that time, a Bachelor of Medicine, called an MB, required 7 years of study, and medical doctorate, MD, required 10 years of study. As a result of these stringent requirements for medical degrees, very few students applied and even fewer graduated. Bologna issued 65 degrees in medicine and only one in surgery between 1419 and 1434. Turin, only 13 medical degrees between 1426 and 1462. The one large medical school, which was considered a model of superior service and training, was in Padua. Here, medical students made up 10% of the student body. Its medical faculty was relatively large, boasting 16 teachers in 1436. By comparison, Oxford had only a single MD on the faculty. So there's the early history of MDs, early history of medical schools. Now, from these early medical schools, we have what we call medicine today, Western medicine. Now, it has an inauspicious start, at least from the Middle Ages on. And notice that early on, they broke up into factions for job security. Today, we call it the American Medical Association. And these various associations are for the purposes of job security. It's to make money. Now, the early thinking behind these was, well, you know, people need help, and we're religious people, and so we're going to open this up, and it's for the Baptists taking care of Baptists or the Catholics taking care of Catholics. Today, medicine is big business. I mentioned this the other day. It represents about 16 to 20% of our whole gross domestic product. Now, 27% of our GDP is made up of inflation. It's just creating money out of thin air. We're on our way into hyperinflation for the rest of you people around the world. If you've got American dollars, you know, you want to get rid of those. It's like you don't want to get rid of AIDS, herpes, or VD. But, you know, leaving that out, it's still it's the biggest single item in our spending plans. We spend more money on medicine than anything else in our society. And the hospital is looked upon as an institution here in the United States. It's like a church. It's a sacred place. And to rail against doctors or hospitals or medicine, you know, it's like railing against Jesus and baptism and Holy Communion. I mean, it's just not done. Just not done. You talk in reverent terms when you talk about doctors and hospitals and disease and pharmaceuticals and things like that. Now, degreed physicians were at the top of the pecking order. However, they were not the only health practitioners. Larger towns and cities were magnets for a wide variety of healers. In 1400, Florence was invaded by medical graduates from Padua and Bologna, bone setters from Rome, and families specializing in eye diseases, hernia, and the stone. Herbalists, midwives, hawkers of home remedies, and priests all sold religious cures. Now, the numbers of health practitioners continued to increase, eventually resulting in the appearance of guilds, apprenticeships, examinations of applicants, locations of pharmacies, supervision of drugs, food, and herbs. By 1236, Florentine physicians and pharmacists joined forces, and they formed a single guild that was officially recognized as one of the city's seven major crafts. Medical organizations formed in many different ways. In southern Europe, surgeons and physicians were equals, and it was encouraged for physicians to also become surgeons. In Frederick II's regulations for the Kingdom of Sicily in 1231, one could only get a license to practice after 5 years of schooling, which included courses and qualifications in surgery. In Italy, the opportunity to take courses in surgery encouraged physicians and surgeons to be cooperative and happy bedfellows. Outside of Italy, surgery was excluded from the university curriculum. In Northern Europe, surgical training and practice were organized as guilds with required apprenticeships and were therefore regarded by licensed physicians as quacks. We have those today. We call them quacks. Alternative health providers are officially known as quacks, and if we catch them, we lock them up, prosecute them. In Paris, the surgeons' organization was established in 1210 after the College of Saint Cosme. Its members were differentiated by long robes and short robes. Only the long robes were allowed to perform surgery. Training was primarily practical, and the college trained three possible degrees, a bachelor's degree, a simple license, and a master. A three-sided faculty war developed between the various physicians on the faculty, the physicians, surgeons, and barbers. The introduction of anatomical dissection to the curriculum further added to the animosity because the dissection was under the direction of physicians and the knives were wielded by the surgeons. So the earliest civic contracts for public physicians were recorded in Reggio, Italy in 1211 and Bologna in 1214, where the contractors were responsible for treating soldiers as well as the common citizens. Contracts commonly imposed a residence requirement, outlined the doctor's private and public duties, and set scales of fees. That price setting there. The civic contract system flourished, and in 1300 they showed up in all the large towns and cities in northern Italy. By 1500, civic doctors were being hired in northern France, Flanders, and several German cities. Only England dragged their feet and failed to hire civic doctors. In 1516, the conflict was resolved by the surgeons agreeing to be supervised by the physicians. Both quickly became allies and attacked the barbers. In Germany and England, barber surgeons were quite common. In Italy, Spain, and southern France, barber surgeons were never accepted. In 1518, the College of Physicians was chartered to regulate and license the practice of medicine in London. Hospitals were the home of surgical teachings and surgeries for the poor. And in 1780, John Howard had inspected Europe's hospitals and found them dripping with filth, pus, gangrene, and infections. Surgery was better performed at the patient's home. Hospital surgical mortality was 300 to 500% higher than for surgeries performed at home. It's like a plague, groaned John Bell. No operation dare be formed. Every cure stands still. Every wound becomes a sore, and every sore is apt to run into gangrene. At the Paris Hotel Dieu, at the hearing of the word surgery, the patients gave themselves up for lost. Simpson coined the term hospitalism, defined as a general morbid condition of the building or of its atmosphere, productive of disease. Simpson believed hospitals should be burnt down every once in a while. In England, the Crimea War from 1854 to 56 brought to the public view the need for sweeping changes in hospital management. Florence Nightingale, who lived between 1820 and 1910, became a heroine. She was from a wealthy, well-educated family born in Florence during a family vacation. She pursued nursing as a mechanism to see the world. After a short stint with the Daughters of Charity in Paris in 1853, Florence Nightingale was appointed superintendent in London of the establishment for gentlewomen during illness, eventually becoming superintendent of nurses at King's College Hospital.
The start of the Crimean War in 1854 was her opportunity to put her theories on cleanliness to work. At the English base at Scutari, across the Bosphorus from Istanbul, hospital conditions were dreadful. Rumors of the neglect of the sick and wounded were confirmed by newspaper stories by William Russell, a London Times reporter. Not only are there not sufficient surgeons, not only are there no dressers and nurses, there's not even linen to make bandages. The London Times demanded action. England responded. Nightingale offered her services to her friend Sidney Herbert, who was then the Secretary of War. Herbert confessed, "There is but one person in England that I know of who would be capable of organizing and superintending such a scheme." A contingent of 38 nurses, 10 Roman Catholic sisters, 8 Anglican sisters, 6 St. John's House nurses, and 14 from various hospitals were gathered and sent over the vigorous objections of the top military leaders to the Crimea. On November the 4th, 1854, Nightingale and her nurses pulled into Scutari, where almost 2,000 wounded and sick soldiers lay in filthy rat-infested wards. 300 scrubbing brushes were promptly ordered. As the cleanliness crusade was in full flower, the Battle of Inkerman was exploding, and the hospital was flooded with armies of the wounded. Florence Nightingale organized the care of the wounded and ultimately called in an additional 80 nurses to bolster her war on filth. She prepared and served meals, supplied bedding, and dealt with the laundry. I'm a kind of general dealer in socks, shirts, knives, forks, and wooden spoons, tin baths, tables, and forms, cabbages and carrots, operating tables, towels, and soap, she exclaimed. In 6 months, she cut the hospital death rate from 40% down to 2%. And when she returned to England in 1856, she was surprised to find herself heralded as a heroine. Nightingale possessed a drill instructor's fortitude and firm hand. Her success in promoting the profession of nursing was owed to her demand that in her Notes on Nursing, published in 1859, on the necessity for nursing applicants to receive an intensive training in nursing theory and practice. Nightingale was a proponent of facts, referring to statistics as the most important science in the world. Not much has changed in modern 20th and 21st century hospitals since the old days of medicine. Sure, there is more chromium, more diagnostic machinery, CT scans, MRI, PET scans, ultrasound, and so on. Yet the mortality statistics are still abysmal. In 1990, a survey by the World Health Organization, that's WHO, and the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, showed that America ranked 17th in longevity when compared with the top 32 industrialized nations. The entire world spent $2.7 trillion for health care. The United States alone spent $1.6 trillion for health care and ranked 17th in longevity. Despite enormous health care spending that eclipsed the gross national product of most nations, the United States dropped to 24th in longevity 10 years later in June of 2000. And 26th in longevity by March of 2005. Boys and girls, we Americans not only aren't the champions in longevity, we're falling further behind. Now, did you get that? Let me read that to you again, because here in America, we think of our hospitals as the bastions of health and longevity. Well, if that wasn't true, how come all these people, when they get sick, want to go to the hospital? I don't hear people say, when they get sick, just leave me alone, let me die here at home. Hell, they want to get to the hospital as rapidly as possible. Now, I already showed you. 300,000 people a year dying in these places. Now, I suppose that 300,000 divided by 37 million is only 0.008%. I mean, it's a small number of people compared to the vast, overwhelming number of people that go to the hospital every year. 300,000 dying isn't that great. But several million are injured in the hospitals. In fact, I think it's 2.4 million are injured in the hospital. 300,000 of them die. So, you know, maybe they cut out the wrong lung. Well, okay, they'll cut the other lung out free. So a little consolation goes along with that. Meanwhile, back on the farm, Joel Wallach points out, he says, get this again. In 1990, a survey by the World Health Organization and the Center for Disease Control showed that America ranked 17th in longevity compared to the top 32 industrialized nations. So they went out and they took a look at 32 countries. Russia, Japan. You know, probably England, France, Norway, and Spain, Sweden, Canada, South Africa, 32 of them. We rank 17th. Now, we spend more money than all the rest of the people in the world combined. That's right. $2.7 trillion a year worldwide spent on healthcare. We spend $1.6 trillion of that. The rest of the world spends $1.1 trillion. We spend $1.6. We spend more money than everybody else in the world on health and healthcare. But in spite of all that money that we spend, it doesn't make us number one in longevity. All right, now next. And the entire world spent $2.7 trillion for healthcare. The United States alone spent $1.6 trillion for healthcare, and yet ranked 17th in longevity despite enormous healthcare spending that eclipsed the gross national product of most countries. Now, the United States dropped to 24th in longevity in 10 years. So we were 17th, and we dropped to 24th in 10 years. And then in 6 years, from 2000 to 2005, we dropped to 26th out of 32. I'd say we're headed in the wrong direction. We spend more money and we get poorer results. We do the same thing in public school. We spend right at $9,000 to $10,000 per student here in the United States. Average, we're spending $9,000 per kid to educate that child in the public school. And our children score at the bottom in every international test around the world. Nobody in the world spends as much money as we do, and they're all smarter than our kids, which just goes to show you, the more money you spend on education, the dumber your kid will become. The more money you spend on health care or hospitals, the sicker and the shorter your life will become. Now, that's the record. That's what the numbers tell us. Florence Nightingale said statistics are where it's at. And let me give you a reminder here. And that is, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. That means don't just knock on the door and expect to come in. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc. That means you don't have to come to school here. We'll send it to you at home. If you'd like more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log, the schedule, and archives, and that can be accessed through the webpage as well. Now, The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports. These reports are done on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate, and that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. And mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Hell's Kitchen. Hell's Kitchen was published by, let me give you some names and numbers here, Wellness Publications, P.O. Box 1222, Bonita, B-O-N-I-T-A, California, 91902. Or you can go to the website. It's www.drjwallach.com. That's D-R-J-W-A-L-L-A-C-H. It's all one word, D-R-J-W-A-L-L-A-C-H.com. That's drwallach.com. They also have a phone number. It's 1-800-755-4656. That's 1-800-755-4656. Or you can probably go to bravenewbookstore.com. That's bravenewbookstore.com. They could also tell you something about this book. This is where I got it. They sent it to me and said, hey, review this. I said, okay, let me do that. They also have an international number. It's 1-619-420-2435. That's local and international calls. I guess you can just order this book directly from the publisher if you want to. Imagine if you got a credit card, and most people do, you could probably just call them on the telephone. That's 1-800-755-4656 in the USA and Canada, or it's 1-619-420-2435, local and international. The book had a number on it. It was about 1895 coming out of Brave New Bookstore. I saw that number on the back of it here. Yeah, it's about 400 pages long. Let me just take a look here. It's 386 pages. And he's got a little section here in the back. Dr. Wallach and Dr. Malan's educational books and tapes to build your health and your knowledge. They got a catalog back here in this book. They've got DVDs. They've got videos. They've got a business toolbox set, information books, booklets and brochures, other tools, audio cassettes. Audio cassettes. I'll tell you, there's one in here, Dead Doctors Don't Lie. God, you'll love it. Dead Doctors Don't Lie. That was the first one I got from Walt. That is so funny. You'll be rolling on the floor with, you know, with the dog and just having a great time over there laughing about medical doctors. Dead Doctors Don't Lie, the original tape that started it all. CD 001. $7 each. Oh, you can get it on video. Look at this. Videos. Dead Doctors Don't Lie. Special offer. DVD 001. Let's Talk Minerals. So here again, all kinds of neat information here. The reason I say this book is a 1 in 100, this is the only guy I've ever heard that ever identified the cause. Identifies the cause. Here's why you're fat. Here's why you're sick. Here's why you need to go to the hospital. It's because you don't have any minerals. Your minerals are lacking. Now you can go to other places. You don't have to buy your minerals from Dr. Wallach. I think he's probably as good as any and better than most, but you need minerals from someplace. I showed you this in the last program. From 1917 to 1937, you lost 50% of your mineral content in your foods here in America. Then from 37 to 75, you lost 50% again. And then from 75 to 2000, you lost another 50%. That's 90% total. That was 87.5% of your minerals lost in 90 years. Now going back here to chapter 4, in 1996, a Harvard School of Public Health survey showed that 180,000 Americans were killed each year in hospitals alone as a result of medical negligence. 1.3 million Americans were physically injured each year in hospitals as a result of medical negligence. In March of 1998, the Center for Disease Control reported that 2 million Americans are infected each year in hospitals alone as a result of medical negligence, and despite around-the-clock nursing and nursing care and intravenous antibiotics, 90,000 of them died. Okay, getting these numbers now? And in November of 1999, according to the Institute of Medicine, medical mistakes and errors ranked as the eighth killer of Americans in hospitals each year. In December of 2002, a Johns Hopkins study elevated medical mistakes to the number three cause of death in Americans each year, killing 250,000. All right, now let's add these up. 250,000 are killed each year. Now, that's, different outfits have different numbers. So, you know, on the one hand, you get the CDC, they come up with numbers. Then you get Johns Hopkins, they'll come up with numbers. And then you get the Food and Drug Administration, they come up with numbers. And I don't know which numbers are telling the truth. But different numbers. I use the conservative numbers. I said, they're killing 300,000. Now, here's Wallach. He gets a study that's done by Johns Hopkins University. They're not a bunch of lowlifes, you know, out here living under a bridge someplace. Johns Hopkins, you know, is a big, respected research hospital here in America. You know, with big-name doctors and all the rest that goes with it. They say 250,000 Americans a year are dead, killed each year, by medical mistakes. Medical mistakes. Cut off, you know, the wrong leg, cut out the wrong lung. And then he points out 90,000 of them died, you know, from, they went to the hospital, and then they got a staph infection. So let's put 90 underneath that one. The first one up here, he says, hey. In 1996, a Harvard Medical School survey showed that 180,000 Americans were killed every year in hospitals only as a result of medical negligence. Now, that medical negligence transfers into drugs. Now, what that drug thing is that drugs, illegal drugs in this country kill 6,000 people a year. Illegal. That's cocaine, heroin, marijuana, you know, ecstasy, whatever you're taking out here, mix and match, you know, crack, whatever, kill 6,000 a year. So we spend billions of dollars. We got a drug czar in this country. We got the federal government laws and all kinds of excitement going on to eradicate illegal drugs in America. Kill 6,000 people a year. These same doctors out here, the legal doctors, are killing 180,000 with legal drugs, for crying out loud. See how many that is, 180,000 divided by 6,000. Medical doctors kill 30 times more people with legal drugs than recreational drug users use killing themselves. 30 times more. Nobody's spending 10 cents to put an end to that or to correct the mistake. Not a dime. And if there is, send me a letter and tell me, and I'll publish it. Now, I'm not here on some crusade trying to get you to stay out of hospitals. Hell, I don't care if you go to the hospital. I personally stay out of the places. I had somebody in the hospital, and I went over and visited him. I should have wore a mask when I went into the damn place, but I didn't. And I went into the hospital 5 or 6 times, came out, and I didn't get diseased, and you know, I survived it. So, you know, if you need to go to the hospital, go as a visitor. If you have to go as a patient, stay at home. Stay at home. Whatever needs to be done, have the doctor do at home. Hell, they figured that out clear back in the 1500s, for crying out loud, that if you go to the hospital, your chances of dying there are much greater than if you do the surgery, if you do whatever it is you're doing at home. Childbirth, same thing. I mean, your chances of living And your chances of your child surviving are much better at home with home birth than they are in hospital. I told you that story. There was a midwife out there, and they call them midwives, you know, but this guy happened to be a man. He delivered over 10,000 babies in 30 years. He's a Mormon guy. And of course, the Mormons, you know, they're all wackos. And so these Mormons are having their babies at home. You know, they got to be wackos to do such a thing, don't they? Anyway, for some reason, these Mormon women, they want to have their babies at home. Well, in all the years that this guy, 30 years, I think if I remember right, the number was 4 babies died. He had 4 died. He was investigated each time. The average pediatrician loses, I think it's 11 a year. I think that's the number I saw here. I mean, just the average Joe Sixpack pediatrician has 11 babies a year die. They don't have any investigations concerning those guys. And America doesn't rank number one in successful births either. We're you know, out of a nation, out of 32 countries, we're down around midway point or something like that. Not at the bottom of the list, but, you know, not at the top either. All right, so the Wallach Carry points out, you know, you got 250 and 90 and 180. And let's add that up. That's 0, 9, 17, 22, 24. That's 520,000. That's 500,000. I said 300,000. I'll stay with the more conservative number. 300,000 a year, at least 300,000 a year are being killed by doctors in hospitals. Or the hospital is killing them, whether they got an infection, the doctor gave them the wrong drug, or he cut out the wrong lung. It's, what the hell's the difference? Dead is dead, you know. So hospitals are dangerous places. They have been dangerous places from day one. So if you want to live longer, stay out of a hospital. In fact, I did some numbers the other day. Your chances of getting killed in a hospital are greater than getting killed on the streets of Baghdad if you're in the Army. So I heard the other day that there's 5,000 soldiers a year now deserting from the Army over in Baghdad, over in Iraq. Hey, I want to talk to you soldiers over there. Don't desert. Don't desert on account of that war. Your chances of getting killed in the hospital back here in the States are greater than over there. Furthermore, the death rate's going down now over there. I did some more numbers over here. If the same number of soldiers were here in America, we'd be killing 2.7 versus 2. So your chances of getting killed over there are 0.7% greater over there in the war zone than they are here in the States. And that's for the same demographics of population, same age group. So first of all, your chances of getting killed over there aren't much greater than getting killed here in the States anyway. It's a little higher, but not much, only 0.7% higher in downtown Baghdad than it is here. That's for Americans. Now, for you Iraqis over there, it's substantially higher, but for the Americans, it's just marginally. Now, if you Americans come back here and check into the hospital, God help you. That's coming right out of Hell's Kitchen here. Each year, 5.8 million American casualties, killed, wounded, and infected, are perpetrated against hospital patients by medical doctors, and yet no one seems to care. It's an unbelievable score that dwarfs the horror of all terrorism and all wars combined. How can this happen? Well, many, many factors are involved. First of all, Americans have a low-functioning immune system to start with for the lack of raw materials, that's minerals, that are necessary to maintain and repair itself. Number two, doctors simply do not pay attention to details of diet. Doctors do not pay attention to supplementation, treatment, surgery, and prescriptions. And this environment encourages obesity, diabetes, and the metabolic syndrome. And third, doctors don't wash their hands. Doctors don't change their clothes. And doctors do not change the shoe covers between patients. Now, you know, let's pause for a moment. I was over in the hospital down here in Mountain Home, and I paid attention to that. And I watched the nurses as they would come in. I'm in here visiting this guy, see? And I'm watching the nurses. I'm watching the doctors come in. Never once did I see a nurse wash their hands, nor the doctor did he ever wash his hands when he came in and touched the patient. Not once. And you're going to say, well, maybe he washed his hands after he left the last patient. Well, maybe he didn't. Because I was watching them and I didn't see him. Now, outside this hospital, they got some of the SantaClean. Outside of every door, they got the SantaClean hook up here on the wall. So you just push the button and wash your hands. Not one nurse, not one doctor did that. And they put the SantaClean outside every one of the doors. Now, back in the Middle Ages, before they knew what a germ was, you could understand it. And they were pretty dirty and they were pretty filthy. And then about 1850 or so, some Austrian doctor, he got to taking a look around. He said, you know, if we'd wash our hands, we'd kill fewer people. Now, when you go into the surgery room, these doctors, you know, they're out here busy. They wash their hands. And they scrub down real good, and they get real excited. It's kind of like a sacrament, kind of like getting ready, you know, for circumcision or something. But that doesn't count, you know, when the doctor isn't going into surgery, when he's just walking back and forth from one room to another, talking to patients and touching people, he don't wash his hands. And they got a study out here. 54% of doctors don't wash their hands between patients. That's the bad news. The good news is 46% do. but they're not down at Baxter Regional Medical Center because I didn't see them doing it down there. And doesn't that include the nurses? And doesn't that include anybody that's going to touch you? Come in and change your catheter, or change your bedpan, or give you some pills or whatever. Number four, doctors lie to insurance companies, private and government, to get paid for procedures that patients don't need or don't receive. And according to the insurance industry, American doctors are responsible for 75% of all health insurance and Medicare fraud. And your doctor gets paid a kickback for prescribing drugs that patients don't need and shouldn't have. Did you catch that? Now, here's a neat little statistic that Wallach gives us that you wouldn't find anyplace else. More than 50% of American doctors are on illegal drugs. More than 50%. Well, what better people to get drugs than the guys that prescribe them? I mean, doctors are drug dealers. You know, you got Tom down on the street corner. He's a drug dealer. And he deals in crack and meth and so on. And then you got your doctor, and he's dealing in drugs also. He deals with different prescriptions. And your doctor is killing $130,000 a year with these bad prescriptions. And Joe down on the street corner, he's only killing $6,000 a year. I don't know, kids. Now, December 8th, 2004, the Los Angeles Times featured a front-page story that revealed the current state of the modern American hospital system. The story described the terrible conditions at the King Drew Hospital and how whole departments fail a hospital's patients. It's a culture of mismanagement which pervades nursing, orthopedic surgery, and residency programs, and the pharmacy. Individual employees' shortcomings often made matters worse. Patients languished unattended by nurses. There was so much stuff at that place, King Drew, you couldn't focus on patient care. And according to the Los Angeles Times, mistakes and lack supervision have debilitated King Drew's pharmacy and doctor training programs, which affect nearly every patient. The Department of Orthopedic Surgery was crippled by employee misbehavior, absenteeism, profiteering, and even the commission of felonies. At King Drew Hospital, it was every doctor, every nurse, and every pharmacist for himself. The patients are relegated to the status of a vehicle that the hospital staff robe to obtain money, drugs, sex, and power. And it was and still is a modern Sodom and Gomorrah. To get off of the road to hell, to eliminate the weight and obesity problems of urban men, we must begin to take control of our own health programs, including weight control and anti-obesity programs. Support your body's raw material needs and boycott the existing medical system of hospitals and surgery. Doctors, hospitals, and the medical system are so busy trying to get their share that they no longer have time for the serious treatment and prevention of the overweight and the obese, much less those that are sick and impaired. Now, there's a little bit more to the story over here. Down in Los Angeles, there was a story running around over here about the Kaiser Permanente company. Kaiser, you know, is a big hospital chain, big insurance outfit, and they provide medical care all over the country, not just in Los Angeles. But down in Los Angeles, they got a program down there in which they take people off the streets. You know, suppose that you're on the street, and you have an epileptic seizure, and somebody, you know, they get nervous about that, and they call an ambulance. The ambulance takes you to the hospital. This is called dumping patients, and so the hospital now has to get rid of you. I mean, they got laws that say they got to admit you. Then after they admit you, they got to dump you. So there was one guy down here. He was a paraplegic. And he was living in his van. He had a van, and he's a paraplegic, and he's got a wheelchair. See? And so he was a Vietnam veteran, I think is what it was. Anyway, this guy's living in his van, and so he has a seizure or something. They take him to the hospital. Then they put him in an ambulance, and they bring him back to the same place where he was found. Now, when they found him, he had his wheelchair, but when they brought him back, they just dumped him on the sidewalk. And he was away from his van. And the only way he could get back and forth to his van where he was living, you know, he's a street guy, was in his wheelchair. So here's this paraplegic now on the sidewalk. He doesn't have a wheelchair. He can't get to his van. I'm kind of smiling a little bit. I can't believe the insanity that goes on here. Yeah, this is in the real world. I'm not reporting this, you know, because this is a joke that came out of Mad Magazine. I'm reporting this because it's a tragedy that goes on every day. And it isn't just Kaiser. It's just that Kaiser got caught more often than anybody else, and they got wrote up, and they got reported. But they reported about, oh, probably 10 of these events over a period of a week that occurred out of this one Kaiser hospital down in L.A. All of them came out of this one Kaiser hospital. And then they reported it goes on with all the hospitals down there. It isn't just Kaiser. Now, that's the hospital in modern America. I mean, you know, if you think the hospital is someplace, you know, where you're going to find the Sisters of Mercy, I mean, you got your head up the wrong end of your anatomy here, kids. Let's grow up and get real. These are places, these are corporate institutions. These are places for making money. Nothing more, nothing less. And there are certain laws and rules and regulations that have to be followed. You know, Congress comes along, they give us some rules and regulations to follow. And then there are certain people that take advantage of those to the detriment of the hospital. So the hospital comes along and says, okay, we got to have a solution to this. So they come up with this dumping program. Now, there's abuses that go on everywhere. I'm not sitting here saying to you, you know, that the hospital is totally at fault or that the patients aren't or don't share some of the blame also or the trouble that goes with it. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. So Joel Wallach comes over and he publishes this in a kind of a humorous way. So if you want to have a couple of three laughs and you want to read a dynamite book that tells you here's where the bodies are buried, Hell's Kitchen is it. And it's the only read that I've had over the years that tells you here's why these people are fat. Here's why these people are sick. It's because they're mineral deficient. They've got a nutritional deficiency. And the doctors aren't curing nutritional deficiencies. They sell drugs. If you came into the hospital and you had scurvy, they wouldn't give you vitamin C. They'd give you a drug that contains vitamin C. You don't need the drug. You just need the vitamin C. And why aren't we just going to give you a tomato to eat or some strawberries? Well, because it's too damn cheap. There's no money to be made feeding you food. The money is made in drugs. So they're going to give you a drug each and every time. Without fail. And that's because that's where the money's at. All right, so there's the story on chapter 4. Remember, this is called Hell's Kitchen. Joel Wallach is the author. And if you can't find it in your local bookstore, then just go to bravenewbookstore.com and they'll get you one. All right, we got to wrap it up. You've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. And we're heard worldwide over the internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.